The opinions and views expressed on this station do not reflect those of KUCI, its Board of Regents. For more information about this or other talk shows, please log on to our website, kuci.org. Good morning and welcome to this October 15th, 2014 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting to you live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org. We are always available via podcast. I'm your co-host, Marie Stone. As always, Writers on Writing is dedicated to the art and business of books. Each and every week, we're here with authors to talk about craft, content, and writing. I'm joined this morning by Meg Wolitzer, author of the young adult book, Beljar, and coming up in the second half hour, Thridi Umnagar will be here to discuss her latest novel, The Story Hour. It's sort of a morning of therapy this morning. Both novels, in very different ways, get at the something similar, writing and storytelling as therapy. So I'm excited to talk with both authors about that. Meg Wolitzer's novels include The Interestings, The Uncoupling, The 10-Year Nap, The Position, and The Wife. She is also the author of the novel for young readers, The Fingertips of Duncan Dorfman. Meg's short fiction has appeared in Best American Short Stories and the Pushcart Prize. Her latest is the young adult novel, Beljar. I hope I'm pronouncing that right, but I'm going to let her pronounce it for me. It's published by Dutton Juvenile, and we're going to chat about it this morning. Meg, welcome back.
Thank you.
We chatted about The Interestings a few years ago, I was mentioning to her, so it's nice to have you back on. So I'm going to give you a chance to introduce, am I saying it right, Beljar? I know it's...
I say Beljar. Okay. A little stress on the first syllable more, but it's fine. I will answer to Madame Bovary.
Yeah, I know, you know, it's a, I know it's a French play on the Beljar, so I was trying, practicing it this morning. I've said it in my head, but I'm not sure I'm saying it right out loud. So I'm going to give you a chance to talk about it a little bit, what inspired it, and take us into the world of Beljar a little bit.
Well, I wanted to write a book about those feelings that can happen in adolescence that just seem too hard to tolerate. You can't take the long view because you haven't lived long enough. And yet, if you could take the long view, you would be able to see that things do change, that they do get better. The book, it's a play on the Beljar, as you say. What happens is a girl named Jim has tragically lost her boyfriend, and she's sent to a boarding school in Vermont for emotionally fragile, highly intelligent teenagers. I would have killed to go to that school. And when she's there, she's put into a class called Special Topics in English, and they only read one writer. And this year, the class is reading Sylvia Plath. Now, you don't have to know anything about Sylvia Plath or even have heard about Sylvia Plath to read my novel, Beljar, but what you do learn is that Plath, who took her own life at 30, was, you know, a great poet and wrote this very autobiographical, intense novel about her breakdown called The Beljar. She also was a big keeper of journals, and the students in Special Topics are given red-letter journals to write in, and when they write in them, each of them is reunited with the thing that they've lost. So Jam is reunited with the boyfriend she's lost. So there's a touch of magic realism, but for me, it's really metaphorical, the idea about wanting something so much that you can't really move on from it. I'm kind of exploring that idea, as well as the notion that that expression, written words, matter, whether it's words you read in a book or words that you might write yourself.
Right. So to talk a little bit about the origins of the novel, did you begin with Jam as a character, or did you begin with kind of the plot point of the journals? Tell me a little bit about your point of entry for it.
I think that novels are sort of like advent calendars. There are a lot of doors and ways in. And for me, I knew I had the idea of wanting to write about being able to get over what is most painful and how your perceptions might not always be exactly the way things really are. But as soon as I had that idea, I knew that a character needed to sort of carry that out. So Jam kind of became developed almost immediately upon having the idea for the book. And that's kind of the way that I've worked with pretty much all of my books in recent years, at any rate. So I knew that I wanted her to be a teenager who was, somewhat lost, but not fatally so, and to sort of take us on her odyssey as she tries to deal with what has happened to her.
Right. You seem very captivated by this what do you call it, age? Well, I mean, the teenage age, but, you know, people on the precipice of teenagehood to adulthood, and certainly the Interestings, you know, had that group of people who met at summer camp at that age. And I, you know, I think it's such a fertile, ripe ground for, you know, the jumping off point of how people are evolving, what they're going to become, all of these possibilities and all of these fears. And I hoped you could talk a little bit about your fascination with that time frame in life and what draws you back to it.
You know, we all have gone through adolescence. Those of us who've made it to adulthood, we've gone through that. And what's so powerful about it is that it's a time of firsts. It's really a time when things are happening for the first time. And I don't know about you, but I remember so many things so strongly because of that. I remember the scent of a Love's Fresh Lemon shampoo that I used. I remember the way my Earth shoes felt on my feet, all of that. And in The Interestings, my most recent novel, which is Four Belts, I was able to literally go back to that era because the novel follows almost 40 years in the lives of its characters. But this time around, I'm really taking the short view. It's a first-person book about a girl who's lost her boyfriend and sent to this boarding school that I described, and how she heals through this class and writing in these journals, how she goes into this world and is reunited with her boyfriend. I'm not remembering things from my own adolescence, but I am remembering that feeling of just being this teenager kind of out and about in the world. You know, you are discovering things for the first time. It might be first love. It might be first loss. First. That's just, there's the power of firsts.
Yeah, right. Yeah, you had mentioned a little bit earlier something about how teenagers haven't experienced that. When I was a teenager, I remember thinking the reason teenage suicide rates are probably so high is because they haven't experienced the entire cycle of pain yet. They don't have any perspective.
Right.
They don't know it's going to get better. And as you say, they're encountering all of these firsts for the first time, and they don't know how to deal with it, and they don't have the emotional equipment yet to get through it. And I was thinking about that cycle of pain for teens. You're right. This what a great spot for these for these teenagers. What a safe spot for these teenagers to be. So tell me a little bit about the school. I assume, are there schools like this? Because we all should have gone to one, and kind of bringing this school to life.
I know, a place where you can basically just kind of go and try to figure out what's going on in your life and be a little bit removed from the, you know, the common core and where you're going to go to college and all of that. And not just that, but from your parents and having to achieve certain things where you can just kind of reflect. There are all kinds of boarding schools. I didn't do research in that way. I know that there are therapeutic boarding schools, certainly, that take all kinds of approaches. So I imagine there are schools like this. But I just kind of imagined it, not even in its super realistic ways as a school of, you know, there's not like group therapy or anything, but the students, their connections with one another becomes the healing thing. When they find out that they each have had this mind-blowing experience of writing in a journal and being able to go back to what they've lost, when they start, it's not so much that they're changed by having that experience as they are, so much by talking about it with each other and writing about it. So it's really about expression, which, you know, I'm obviously, as a writer, I'm a big believer in that.
Right. My guest this morning is Meg Wolitzer. The book is Bell Jar. It's published by Dutton. Sylvia Plath was such a great, you handled her so deftly because, you know, I think too much Plath in a novel for young adults might feel overwhelming to them or might be off-putting. I don't know what it might be. But she was a really nice background character, kind of the Greek chorus of the novel.
Yeah,
but she wasn't, she certainly wasn't overbearing. And I was wondering about your choice of Sylvia Plath, what she's meant to you, and you know, kind of handling her in the novel a little bit, if you could talk about her.
Sure. I have various connections to Sylvia Plath. One is that I went to Smith for a while before I transferred to Brown, and when I was at Smith, the presence of Plath, who did herself go to Smith College in Northampton, Massachusetts, could really be felt, especially back then. in the era when, you know, people were still talking about Plath. She was this icon. Her suicide, you know, had contributed a lot to this image of her. And she was this girl of promise, you know, who had, whose life had been cut short. And beyond that, I then went on to win the Mademoiselle Guest Editor Contest that Sylvia Plath had won, and which the character in The Bell Jar wins when she goes to New York. If you remember the book, goes to New York to work at a fashion magazine. I did that. Mm. Now, when I was there, you know, we all felt the presence, the ghostly presence of Plath, having been there before, stayed at the Barbizon Hotel for Women, where men weren't allowed above the first floor. But then even really moving forward, I think Plath, well, first of all, teenagers I've talked to today, many of them don't know who Sylvia Plath is. They've never heard of her, and they don't read her in school. Hmm. Some do, some have, but many don't. And I, the reason that I put Plath in a very minor way in Bell Jar is just because I didn't want it to be, it's not a novel of Sylvia Plath. I mean, some people sort of wrongly reported that it was.
Yeah.
But I could understand that because it was, you know, I used Plath in a kind of twisty way to stand for, look, a you know, a young bookish woman who is caught in the bell jar of her depression and feels isolated from the world. To me, I was thinking, well, that's a nice metaphor, the idea of, you know, Plath used it as a metaphor, and I'm taking it further, which is that, you know, teenagers generally feel sometimes like they are caught up in something that keeps them separate from everyone else, and how painful that is, especially when you don't think that it can ever get better.
Right, right. Yeah, when I picked up the book, I was expecting her to be a greater character or force when I read it, and I really thought you handled her nicely, and I'm hoping, my daughter's reading the book now, and I'm hoping that this inspires her to look into Plath's poetry. Yeah, yeah.
That's an extra bonus if that happens, and a couple of people actually said that to me, that now they want to go back and read Sylvia Plath either again or for the first time, and I think that's terrific.
Yeah, and you said I think you said it in an interview, not in the book, but she really is a great writer for across ages. You know, she speaks well to adolescents, and she speaks well to 20-somethings, and, you know, I'm sure she probably speaks well to adults, even though she didn't make it all the way into her 40s or 50s, but, you know, her work is just so accessible at different points in your life, which is nice too. Let's talk a little bit about voice and finding Jam's voice. You said, you know, that you wrote this novel in first person, which is something I think you've only written in first person in one other novel.
Mm-hmm. The Wife. Yeah.
Yeah. And so talk a little bit about finding Jam's voice and finding a first person voice and, you know, maybe your decision to write this in first person and how it served this book as opposed to, you know, writing in third person in other novels.
You know, the other book in which I've written first person is The Wife, as I said, and what the two books have in common is that they both have a narrator who's not entirely what we call reliable. And I mean, what teenager is a reliable narrator? What adult is entirely a reliable narrator anyway? But the reason to use first person, I think there has to be a real reason. First-person voices, you don't want them to just be like every person, generic. I don't even think there is an every person. There isn't a generic voice. You want your first-person book to feel, to use a highly literary term, voicey. And I think that in both instances, the first-person voice allows you to both reveal and maybe not reveal some things. Mm. The character is deciding what should be told, as opposed to the third person, which we think of as somewhat faithfully rendering the story. So here was this girl, Jam, who's lost her boyfriend. She's been sent to this boarding school for emotionally fragile, highly intelligent teenagers, and she just hates everything. She gets to narrate the story in almost real time, really kind of telling what it feels like to be her. It's kind of breathless. It's kind of urgent. Her story needs to get out. I wanted to tell it over the course of one semester, as opposed to in The Interestings, when the narrative takes place over almost 40 years. This isn't going to be that. This is about the most intense thing that happened to her and how it's unfolded in, you know, recent days for her. It's a little more breathless. It's a little more urgent. It's less digressive. It's less discursive. That's how I heard her voice. I think that it bears something in common with feelings that I had in adolescence. Oh, my God, you have to, you know, just the way it's like when groups of teenage girls are shrieking with laughter on the subway, and you remember, I mean, not that we don't laugh, too, but when you remember that, just that helpless feeling and the excitement of being together and the way you had to sort of explosively express things, that moment, I tried to get some of that across.
Right, right. Yeah, I wanted to talk about unreliable narrators, obviously, without revealing plot points or anything. But your observation here about how first person serves the unreliable narrator much better than third person would, I hadn't thought about that. But that's exactly right, that unreliable narrators probably should be written in first person. And you're right that who among us is a reliable narrator of our lives or other lives, or, you know, it's... As we always talk about how truth is better told through fiction, and nobody is reliable. There's a lot of different stories out there.
Yeah. No, it's really true. I mean, I never want to say hard and fast that this form is better for this kind of narrator. I mean, people break and bend rules constantly, and that's one of the great things about writing fiction.
Right. You had talked about not wanting to put the jaded bits of yourself and your life experience onto jam. As author, you know, you don't want to put your own life experience into somebody who hasn't had the life experience. And I thought that was very interesting and well observed. And I was wondering if we could talk a little bit about keeping your own experience out of this person's experience and how difficult that was. You know, crawling inside her skin and trying to forget how life has molded you in order to write her character.
Well, I think one of the ways that I handled that was by having her teacher as a character, who is the wise old woman. And I hope I'm not a wise old woman, but I don't think I'm not nearly as old as the teacher in the book. But there was a sort of, you know, contrapuntal voice by having a teacher who has lived and knows some things, and she's chosen the kids. She's handpicked the kids for this class for reasons that they don't understand, but which will come to be revealed to them. I think when you write, I mean, it's not like if children's books had to be written by children and books about old people had to be written by old people, you know, it would be limiting. It would be limiting. There is something to the power of invention, and also when you're writing about being young, you're writing about a lot of other things, too. So I try to not leave myself behind, but I also try not to do that thing that I want to do, which is kind of like the equivalent of tucking in your kid's shirt. you know, it's like we sometimes can't help but do that in our lives, and we try not to do that as writers. You don't want to sort of tuck in the shirt of the character. You want to let the character take the journey for herself. But you're there. You're there guiding it and making sure that the journey, at least, is revealed, you know, rather than changed by the wisdom that you have from your own life experience. You know, there was a great line that I think the creators of Seinfeld, it might have been Larry David, I don't know, but I read it somewhere long ago. I can't say where exactly, but the creators of Seinfeld had a motto for the show, which was no hugging, no learning. And I like that idea because it just, they wanted to free the show from the conventions of the typical sitcom in which somebody, you know, reaches an epiphany at the end and they all hug. You don't want to do that in novels either, regardless of whether they're for teenagers or for adults.
I was just reading something the other day about editors giving writers advice, you know, 10 pieces of advice that they see over and over. And one of them was that writers tend to put themselves in the character's position and say, okay, what would I do as opposed to what would this character do? And
yeah.
I guess this goes to that point. You really have to say, what would this person do with their background and their, you know.
Right. They're not you, but you know them.
But you're right. But you know them. My guest this morning is Meg Wolitzer. The book is Beljar. It's published by Dutton. This might be a great time for you to read to us. Can you read to us a little bit from the book?
Yeah, absolutely. So this is just the very opening of my YA book, Beljar. I was sent here because of a boy. His name was Reeve Maxfield, and I loved him, and then he died. And almost a year passed, and no one knew what to do with me. Finally, it was decided that the best thing would be to send me here. But if you ask anyone on staff or faculty, they'll insist I was sent here because of the lingering effects of trauma. Those are the words that my parents wrote on the application to get me into the Wooden Barn, which is described in the brochure as a boarding school for emotionally fragile, highly intelligent teenagers. On the line where it says, reason student is applying to the Wooden Barn, your parents can't write because of a boy. But it's the truth. When I was little, I loved my mom and dad and my brother Leo, who followed me everywhere and said, Jammy, wait. When I got older, I loved my ninth grade math teacher, Mr. Mancardi, even though my math skills were deeply subnormal. Ah, Jam Gallahue, welcome, Mr. Mancardi would say when I came to first period late, my hair still wet from a shower, sometimes in winter with the ends frozen like baby twigs. I'm tickled that you decided to join us. He never said it in a nasty tone of voice. I actually think he was tickled. I was in love with Reeve in a fierce way that I'd never been in love with anyone before in all my 15 years. After I met him, the kinds of love I'd felt for those other people suddenly seemed basic and lame. I realized that there are different levels of love, just like different levels of math. Down the hall in school back then, in advanced math, a bunch of geniuses sat sharing the latest gossip about parallelograms. Meanwhile, in Mr. Mancardi's dumb math, we all sat around in a math fog, our mouths half open as we stared in confusion at the ironically named smart board. So I'd been in a very dumb love fog without even knowing it, and then suddenly I understood that there was such a thing as advanced love. Reeve Maxfield was one of three 10th grade exchange students, having decided to take a break from his life in London, England, one of the most exciting cities in the world, to spend a semester in our suburb of Crampton, New Jersey, to live with dull, cheerful jock Matt Kesman and his family. Reeve was different from the boys I knew, all those Alexes, Joshes, and Matts. It wasn't just his name. He had a look that none of them had, very smart, slouching, and lean, with skinny black jeans hanging low over knobby hip bones. He looked like a member of one of those British punk bands from the 80s that my dad still loves, and whose albums he keeps in special plastic sleeves because he's positive they're going to be worth a lot of money someday. Once I looked up one of my dad's most prized albums on eBay and saw that someone had bid 16 cents for it, which for some reason made me want to cry.
That's fantastic. That was Meg Wolitzer reading from Beljar. I love this comparison of love to different levels of math. And I thought, that's so true.
There's an example of, you know, working with what your character knows. When you're a teenager, school, it's like the funny thing about the school is this main point of reference because, you know, when you read a novel written for adults, you often make a choice to read it based on whether, that's about the world of lawyers. That's about the world of deep-sea fishermen. Kids don't have, you know, full-time jobs yet, mostly. You're often reading about a kid in school all day. So that's their world. That's their job. Or a lot of books about teenagers.
Right. No, I mean, it worked on so many levels because it's true of their experience and it's true in general. An adult can look back on that and say, you know, that's pretty well observed. That's right. Speaking of that, maybe we could talk a little bit about if you feel that there are, I don't like to call it rules for writing or rules for genre, but are there things in your mind that you're cognizant of when writing a YA book versus writing adult novels? I mean, the subject matter is certainly just as complex. The emotions are just as complex. The narrators tend to be adolescents, but are there other things that separate it into the YA world?
You know, I tend to think a little bit more about my reader, or a lot more, when I'm writing for teenagers than when I'm writing for adults, because I want to respect their field of interest, as you say. I'm not going to, you know, I'd be hard-pressed to write a book about a woman with an AARP card and call it a YA book. But even beyond that, really, I think the desire to have the story and the meaning of the story kind of come through in a more urgent way is something that I just innately feel. And it's not that I think that there's a rule book, but I'm trying to kind of channel what I like to read at that age and the kind of books that I wanted to find on the shelf. I mean, I often wanted to read books about girls in trouble, things that had kind of stark moments of emotional drama. And I think when I'm writing, like when I wrote The Interestings, I could take a little more time because I know there's time. I know that things unfold maybe slowly. When I was young, I didn't. Everything had to happen. Everything had to happen right then. So I think that I'm a little more, a little antsier maybe with my narrative writing for adolescents.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Were there characters in here that that gave you particular problems? There are a whole cast of wonderful other adolescents, and I was wondering if there were characters whose point of entry were was a little bit more difficult to access.
Well, somebody called the book something like The Breakfast Club Meets Prep. You know, that there's this group of kids who are thrust together and they don't think they have anything in common at this boarding school. You know, I really like writing boy characters and male characters, and it's a challenge always as a female person. Not, you know, just to get into anybody else's head, it's always a challenge. But I think to write about a teenage boy, I'm the mother of two sons, and I really learned a lot from my younger son when he came home talking about the book Looking for Alaska by John Green. And this is before John Green mania was, of course, nearly as big as it is now. And I didn't really know who that was. I hadn't really heard of that book. I didn't know much about it. But it was important to him. And reading it and reading the sort of sensitive male characters, I just wanted to try to do that, but I wanted to get it right, and I'm a little nervous that, you know, as I'm writing it, am I getting it right? Am I doing that? So I had adolescents to sort of run things by and ask questions of, and that's always helpful.
Yeah, that is helpful. What was the most difficult part of this project? Were there sticking points for you?
Well, without giving anything away, I will say this. There's a sort of twist at the end. There's a reveal, as they say, that kind of, you know, that's about the perception of the character, and it kind of goes into a different place that I didn't know all along I was going to do, but when it became clear that Jam's story had to be told in a certain kind of way, I mean, I love the line, the Emily Dickinson line, tell the truth, but tell it slant. The novels that I like, I think, are generally told slant. So there's a little bit of a slant here. Getting that right and not being gimmicky about it was tremendously important. I think plot, for me, plot is always a little tough. Because in order to have things happen and have readers care about them, they can't only just be intrinsically that feels like what would have happened, but they have to kind of reveal some larger ideas about the characters and the world they live in. So for me, creating that for Jam is on the road to making her just grow up a little bit and be aware of things in a new way. So even though there's no hugging and no learning, there's changing. And I think, you know, teenagers are transforming physically and emotionally every second of every day, like a speeded-up flower film that you might see on YouTube. So putting a little bit of that in a concentrated way was a challenge, but also a pleasure.
Yeah. Since you brought it up, because I didn't want to, you know, no reveals of the end, but at what point was that known to you about Jam?
Not right away, but I don't know exactly when. But when I realized it at some point, I got excited to sort of try to, you know, play a little bit with a narrative and just sort of look at what's going on and look at ideas of reliability and people's versions of the truth and people's versions of what they believe and what they feel, which we have to respect because it's their reality. And I think that it was really as much about that as anything else. I mean, some people are annoyed with characters that you write, because, and they will tell you this, whether on Amazon or, you know, in person, because they don't like that the character was selfish or boring or whatever, but, you know, people are those things, and I think that sometimes characters are not even able fully to accept what's going on, and you as the writer can't push them into that. You have to just kind of show it,
right.
Show what's happening to them.
Right, right. Darn it, we're drawing down on our time. Are you going back to the adult world, or are you going to stick with YA for a little while?
Yes.
Going back to the adult
world? I'm doing both. My next book is an adult book, and along long adult book, so I'm in the middle of that. But I am going to be doing more YA books after that. But the next book that you will see from me will be for adults. Although it's funny because, you know, this with Belshar, there's a huge crossover readership now of YA. People who really want to read books that take place in the world of, you know, younger people. And there's not one kind of YA book. There's such a wide variety of books that it's a, you know, it is a category, yes, but it's so incredibly broad. And I think that it's kind of great that there are adult and young readers.
Oh, I know.
There are younger readers who seek out adult books.
Right. Yeah. No, it definitely crosses age groups. I know so many adults who read YA and vice versa. I know so many teens who read adult books. So it's, yeah, and you're right. The sea is very wide when it comes to the different types of YA and its own genre. It's really
wonderful. Yeah. It's amazingly broad and diverse. Absolutely.
Yeah. So we can find you online at megwalitzer.com, I think, right?
Yes.
Yeah, there's some great, you've got wonderful interviews up, and certainly you can learn more about your other novels if you haven't read all of the other ones out there. There are so many. And are you doing any book tours out on the West Coast?
I am actually out in L.A. tomorrow doing some events that I think are on my website, and a book fair, an indie bookseller conference, and speaking at a lunch and doing a bunch of things like that. And it's great to talk about Belshar with readers, either if they haven't read the book or if they have. There's this connection when you're talking about books for younger readers that I'm really enjoying that conversation with booksellers and readers.
Right, right. And, you know, I think we didn't talk about too much, but this notion of writing as therapy, reading as therapy, especially for this age group of adolescents, I think is an important message to get across. And it's...
Books have been so powerful for me. The moments that you spend with a book are moments that the rest of the world falls away, and the world that's created within the book replaces it. And sometimes it's just a concentrated, powerful place to be, and I've gotten so much from the things I've read, and I just wanted to kind of convey that idea in this book. I mean, I have an idea that books are a hot object, and I felt that way since I was young, and now, of course, books are changing platforms. Maybe somebody's reading, on an e-reader, but everybody has a desire for narrative, a desire for story.
Now they're literally hot objects because your iPad heats up while
you're... Yes, I know. It's true. They get really hot really fast. If I read on my computer, it's like practically like a Benihana grill.
Right, it's burning your lap. Yeah.
Yes. Yes.
Meg Walitzer, thank you so much for coming back on. Huge pleasure.
Oh, thank you. Bye-bye.
We're going to take a short break, but please stay with me. 3D Umnagard will be here for the second half hour. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org. This show will join the other interviews up on the web and available to you via podcast. Feel free to visit iTunes. We're under College Radio. Or you can always visit Barbara's website, penonfire.com. There are direct downloads as well as information on our hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of podcasts of past shows. You can find out who is coming up in the next coming weeks. She's got information on speaker series events and more up there. I'm your host, Marie Stone, guest host Marie Stone. And on with the show. I'm joined now by Thridi Umnagar. Thridi is the author of 6 novels, The World We Found, The Weight of Heaven, The Space Between Us, If Today Be Sweet, Bombay Time, and most recently, The Story Hour. The memoir, The First Darling of Morning, is also hers. An award-winning journalist, she has been a contributor to The Washington Post, The Boston Globe, The Huffington Post, as well as other publications. She's the winner of the Nieman Fellowship at Harvard, the 2009 Cleveland Arts Prize, and the Seth Rosenberg Prize. She's now a professor at English at Case Western University. She joins me from Cleveland, Ohio, to talk about The Story Hour. It's published by HarperCollins, and it's my huge pleasure to have her on. Thridi, welcome.
Marie, thank you so much for having me.
Thanks so much for coming on. I've been a fan of yours since Bombay Time. I am a huge fan of Indian literature, and this. So I was very excited to read this, and it did not disappoint. Let me tell you.
Great! Thank you.
Great. So take us a little bit into The Story Hour. Talk about for those people who haven't read it yet. It's pretty newly out. Talk about kind of the world of these two women.
Yeah, sure. I should just apologize. I'm recovering from a cold, so my voice might sound a little off at times. I'll do my best. But The Story Hour is the story of two women. One is Lakshmi, who's, a recent immigrant to the U.S. She's been in the country for about 6 years. She's here because of an arranged marriage to this guy who owns an Indian grocery store. And when the novel opens, we find out that Lakshmi has just attempted to take her own life. She's very isolated in her life in America and, just doesn't see any purpose in going on. And she's a young woman. She's only in her 30s when she tries this. But because of this, I mean, obviously she survives the attempt. And because of that, she comes in contact with Maggie Bowes, who's an African-American therapist married to an Indian man. And Maggie quickly realizes that really what Lakshmi needs more than just sort of conventional therapy is friendship. And then later on, sort of economic independence so that she can build a life for herself, apart from her life with her husband. And the story then really is about this very odd and unlikely friendship that springs up between the two women and the risks and dangers of secrets spilling over that friendship then entails.
Right. Talk a little bit about the point of entry of the novel for you. If it started with character, if it started with one of these two women, or if it started with an idea.
Yeah, that's very interesting because every other book I've done up to this point basically came to me whole. I saw the characters, and almost simultaneously with seeing the characters, I understood what the plot of the novel was going to be. This book was different in that each one of these two central female characters basically starred, if you will, in short stories of their own. So I had written a short story with a character very much like Lakshmi. And then maybe a few years after that, I wrote another short story with somebody like Maggie in it. And about a year and a half ago, I woke up in the morning from a deep sleep, like just jumped out of bed thinking, I want to introduce these two women to each other because I think they like each other, and I'm interested in finding out what happens if they meet each other because there's very little in each one of their lives that you would automatically think of them ever seeking each other out or being part of the same social circle or being friends. They come from very different walks of life. Lakshmi only has like an 8th grade education, and that too, like in a rural school. English is not her first language. Maggie, of course, she has a PhD. She's highly educated. She's affluent. She's in a very happy marriage. So they come from very, very different walks of life. And I just thought it was an interesting experiment to see what would happen between these two women if they were introduced by me to each other.
It must be kind of nice to have two characters with such incredibly distinct voices. Lakshmi has a dialect that's, you know, her speech patterns are, as you say, reflective of her English as a second language, and, you know, not so well educated. I assume that must have made it very easy to keep these two women very separate in your mind when you were writing the two voices. But tell me about switching back and forth between them, and if that... Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I guess easy is not a word that I associate with this particular novel, only in that it was really, really, you know, Lakshmi's section is told in the first person, and it's told in this rather, idiosyncratic, you know, ungrammatical, broken English that she speaks in. And it was hard. It was hard finding that voice and making sure that it didn't kind of devolve into a kind of caricature, you know. I wanted readers to respect Lakshmi's intelligence. And I know just from, you know, from living, from real life, that we often make snap judgments about people based on language, based on how well or how poorly they speak. And I wanted to write Lakshmi's character in a way that, yes, I mean, her grammar is atrocious and her English is just really, really bad, but that should never sort of mask or hide the very formidable intelligence and warmth and humor that is Lakshmi. So it was quite a challenge getting that voice just right. I played with just writing it and her passages in standard English, and it just didn't seem right because that's not how she was speaking to me. So by the time I would get to a Maggie chapter, which was written in third person standard English, it was like, it was just a joy. You know, those passages came so effortlessly compared to the struggle that I had to go through writing the Lakshmi chapters.
Is that how she was, excuse me, is that how she was written in the short stories as well?
You know, that's a very good question. I'd have to go back and see. I think so, yeah. I don't really remember, to be honest with you. I haven't looked at that short story in a very long time. But clearly, she still speaks in this kind of, you know, pidgin kind of English.
Is the short story out there in the world? Was it published somewhere?
No, it's out there in my computer, on my hard disk somewhere.
Rats.
I don't try very hard to publish short stories because I don't really consider myself to be a short story writer. So I guess I'm a little self-conscious about that yet.
So do you do the short stories as a way of generating novelish material, or do you do it just for your own pleasure of writing short stories?
Yeah, the latter, I think. Yeah, I've never sort of written a short story with the aim of turning it into a novel at some future date. It just so happened to be the case in this particular instance.
Right, right. Well, I introduced this show by talking about how both novels get at writing as therapy, storytelling as therapy, and the therapeutic nature of telling your own life tale. And you'd done an interview, which I thought was a really interesting observation you had about once your central narrative emerges, once that happens,
yes,
then you can kind of play with the narrative that you tell yourself about yourself,
yes,
with the goal of changing. And tell me a little bit about what you learned therapy-wise, storytelling-wise through this novel.
Yeah, you know, I it was very interesting in the course of writing this book because, like, I kept grappling with two concepts, and in some ways they almost, if you look at it superficially, they almost seem like contradictions, but I don't really think they are. But the first one was simply grappling with this craziness of, you know, here's somebody like Maggie trying to impose a kind of medical, you know, psychiatric system on somebody who doesn't even recognize the rules or doesn't recognize the very terms. I mean, somebody from Lakshmi's very feudal, you know, rural background where she's constantly surrounded by extended family and the other people in the village, you know, a real sense of a thriving community where if she has a problem, she would turn to her parents or she would turn to an elder in the village. So the very concept of paying somebody else to kind of professionally listen to your problems is a completely strange and alien concept to her. And poor Maggie, bless her heart, I mean, she really, really struggles with this. You know, she makes a very valiant attempt to sort of try and convince or make Lakshmi understand what they're trying to do in these weekly sessions. But Lakshmi just sees the time that they spend together as she puts it, quote unquote, making friendship, you know. Mm-hmm. And that indeed becomes the story hour. So the first thing I was dealing with was simply this issue of, does, you know, if therapy is sort of this, you know, middle class, mostly Western concept, how do you translate it to somebody who just doesn't recognize the central assumptions behind therapy?
Right.
But having said that, I also felt like there indeed is something amazingly powerful in telling your own story to another human being, because that's that moment of transformation that has the potential of occurring. You know, that in telling your story out loud to another person, you begin to recognize the stories that you are telling yourself, you know, that sort of shape you as a human being. And I guess the question I was interested in exploring is, if you tell yourself a different story about your own life, is that how change and healing happens?
And even down to the language, the very specific words you use, even if they're synonyms to each other, can have a drastic effect on how you view yourself, I think. You
know? Yes, exactly so. Yeah. Exactly so.
Yeah, as you're talking about this, I was thinking about how, obviously your observation is right, that therapy is not a common practice in a lot of these either rural villages or other countries, but how storytelling in those places is so incredibly important. And
exactly.
Lakshmi was talking about how she was a big storyteller in her village. And so you wonder if they're doing therapy, even if that's not what they're calling it, right?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I mean, that's one of the things that really struck me in writing this book is that, you know, we can talk about talk therapy in this sort of esoteric way that we sometimes do, but ultimately you can almost boil it down to or reduce it to, you know, it's simple storytelling. It's the pleasure and the comfort of storytelling.
Right, right. My guest this morning is Thridi Amrugar. The book is The Story Hour. You are listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. I don't think it's uncommon to have secrets revealed in novels and unreliable narrators. We were talking about unreliable narrators in the first half hour, and I don't want to give any secrets away here.
Right.
So maybe we'll have a philosophical discussion about unreliable narrators and managing secrets. But tell me a little bit about when things were known to you as a writer, not what was known, but when things were known. Or if it was revealed to you through the writing process, these characters' backstories, and kind of managing it for the reader, when to disseminate particular amounts of information, when you know you've gone too far, you know, kind of that balancing act.
Yes, it's a great question, by the way. Maggie's secret, which is revealed to the reader very early on also, was known to me very, very early on. I mean, when I was shaping the book, I knew that Maggie would have her own secret that she would keep from Lakshmi and everybody else for that matter. I think, I'm trying to remember, it's been a while since I wrote the book, but I think Lakshmi's big secret revealed itself to me, you know, a little into the writing process. I don't think I knew that when I conceived of her character. But one of the reasons why that secret is so important to this book is that it completely changes the way Maggie looks at Lakshmi, you know. Mm-hmm. And in by doing so, I think it also changes the way the reader looks at Lakshmi. And, you know, I think this just goes back to my sort of core belief of how incredibly complicated and ultimately unknowable human beings are. I mean, not only do we keep secrets from each other, I think very often we keep secrets from ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wanted both the reader and Maggie to discover Lakshmi's secret at the same moment, because I wanted that shift in perception of who Lakshmi really is to happen for both the reader and Maggie at precisely the same moment.
Mm, very nice. I don't want to devolve too much into therapy for you, but I was wondering if these books, what they teach you, what your novels may, and this novel in particular, may teach you, not just as writer, but also as human being, if there are things revealed to you about human nature through the writing process that, and maybe new discoveries about how people work that you came across in writing this.
Yeah, again, a very good question. I think the number one thing, and I don't know that this was a new discovery, but every book that I write seems to just hammer home the same point for me, is just what rich interior lives all human beings have. And some of us are lucky in that we find an expression for those interior lives. You know, me, by being a novelist, I can write that complexity out of my system, so to speak. But even somebody like Lakshmi as a character, I mean, she has a friend like Maggie to whom she can, confide it. Some people have that, but I suspect that the vast majority of people on Earth walk around, you know, with their secrets and their demons rattling within them, unable to express them.
Yes.
And there's a kind of sadness that realization produces in me, that there might be so much hurt and pain that is just masked, you know, and people just live their lives the best they can, but hiding and harboring those kinds of secrets. And the other thing is just the sheer importance of human communication. I think when bad things happen in my novels to my characters, most of the time it's because people are hiding their true selves from each other. You know, somebody's on the verge of saying something, and then ego or pride or hurt or whatever, any number of things keep them from expressing that. So the health, you know, just the good health that good communication produces. And then, of course, its opposite, shadow image. Those are the two revelations that I think I keep stumbling upon over and over again.
Yeah, yeah. Very good observations. Somebody told me that, you know, you should look at your box boy or the bagging boy at the grocery store the next time and think of all the operatic passions that he has boiling up beneath
beautiful.
Him. And I've never looked at a person in the grocery store again as I'm walking down the aisles. I'm like, look at all these operatic passions that these...
I know. I don't always succeed, but I try and do this when I'm driving and somebody cuts me off or makes a really dumb move. And, you know, my instinct is to blow the horn. And instead, I try and sort of create this life for them, you know, what happens in their life at exactly that moment. I think it's a good, even if it's not true, it's a good way of getting, it's a kinder way of getting through life, I think.
Absolutely. You know? That's why they say writers and readers are so empathetic, because you're accustomed to putting yourself into everybody else's shoes and viewing the world through other points of view. And that empathy, you know, just makes you a nicer person, I think, to be around.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, now there's this whole backlash against, you know, that sort of old belief of literature does, it makes you more noble, it makes you a better person. And now, of course, it's very trendy to say, well, there's no scientific evidence of that. And in fact, this study has proven just the, you know, but I just don't buy those studies. I think to me, it just feels instinctive that when you understand, when you have empathy and when you understand another human being's suffering or sorrow, or just the complexity and the richness of their lives, it can't help but make you a better person.
Right, right. We're drawing down on our time, but I wanted to real quick hit on your male characters. There are a small cast of men in here who aren't at the forefront of the stage, but they certainly play a role. And making them, you know, it would be easy to kind of put them into cliches or stereotypes, but giving them depth and shaping them out a little bit. Tell me a little bit about writing men and if any of these men gave you any pause or problems.
No, actually, they were quite a joy to write. Shadir, Maggie's husband, is probably my most favorite person in this book. I love Shadir. You know, he's an uncomplicated guy. He kind of wears his heart on his sleeve, but when it comes to his wife, but he's not a sentimental person. You know, he's not somebody who brags a lot, or he's just one of those good salt of the earth kind of guys who goes about his business and, you know, dotes on his family and just makes life a little better for everybody around him. And to me, Sudhir is sort of the hero of the book. Lakshmi's husband, of course, is a whole different ball of wax, but I would like to believe that by the time you get to the end of the book, you begin to see his humanity, and more than his humanity, you begin to see his outrage. And, you know, going back to an earlier question that you asked about the secrets in the book, one of the things I wanted to do is, you know, Western readers have some very stereotypical images in their heads about Indian women and, you know, the stereotypes being Indian women are docile and meek and, you know, oppressed by patriarchy and all those things. And like most stereotypes, there's tons of truth in this. But the fact of the matter is I wanted to show that even within those stereotypes, there's so much room for individual behavior, you know.
Right.
And so I hope that the reader feels some measure of sympathy for Lakshmi's husband.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. No, they're all full developed, beautiful, beautiful characters. 3DM Nagar, I'm so sorry we ran out of time. This always happens to me, but it was such a pleasure to have you on. You've been a quiet hero of mine since Bombay time, and this was really a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you. What a sweet thing to say.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
That was 3D Amrigar, the book, The Story Hour. You can find her online. I think it's amrigar.com, and she's got some great interviews up there. You can find a ton of interviews she's done. This interview will be podcast for hopefully fairly soon and available for your listening pleasure. That's all the time we have for this week. Stay tuned. Teddy is coming up with a little bit of reggae, and we're going to be right back here with you next Wednesday morning at 9 a.m. So until next time, thanks so much for joining me. Have a great day.